tell you, for anybody out there that's struggling, this is how I knew I had a problem. Anybody that thinks they don't have a problem is that when you're successful like me, when you're hiding bottles, and also because I was drinking so much vodka, Kettle One was my favorite. Because I always say my favorite cocktail was Kettle One and cocaine, right?
That was a Kettle One drinker.
Yeah. So my drinking got so much that I had to switch down from Smirnoff to Skol and pour it in the Kettle One bottles. So people thought they were getting, and I was buying, at the end, I was like the cheap Rock Gut vodka in the plastic handles without even a handle on it, you know, and that's what I switched to. So anybody that sees that kind of activity, you might have a problem.
You're listening to Real Recovery Talk with your host, Tom Conrad. Every day, Tom helps guide people like you who have loved ones dealing with addiction. You're most likely frustrated with the situation, worried your loved one won't get better, and concerned you're not doing enough to help. This show will help you understand the tremendous struggle of addiction from your loved one's perspective. You'll hear stories of recovery, which will give you hope. And you'll understand the limits to what you can and can't do to help those you love. Tom is a certified addictions counselor who's successfully winning his own battle with drug addiction and alcoholism and has helped many others win theirs as well. It's time now for Real Recovery Talk.
Here we are, Real Recovery Talk. I am your host, Tom Conrad. In today's episode, we have Benjamin B.
What's happening, everybody?
And we have a gentleman by the name of John.
John S.
Hey, John S.
My name is John S., and I'm an alcoholic, a real alcoholic.
Thanks, John, for coming on. First and foremost, go to realrecoverytalk.com. There you will find every single episode that myself and Ben has ever released. I think, John, you're going to be 144. Or 145 or something like that. I don't know. RealRecoveryTalk.com. Every single episode, all about addiction, alcoholism, you name it, it is there. If it's yourself that is struggling with addiction or alcoholism, or if one of your loved ones or a close friend of yours is struggling, go in there, scan the episodes, look at the title, see what resonates with you, and take a listen. And if you need any help with anything, you can always reach out to myself at tom@realrecoverytalk.com and ben@realrecoverytalk.com. Just a disclaimer, though, we will ask you for your phone number. So if you're not down with having phone conversations and you want to have an elaborate conversation via email, don't bother. I hate to cut straight to the point, but we need to have conversations over the phone. I eventually am going to write a book called Don't Email Me if you want to have a in-depth conversation, because it's impossible, I think. So anyways, realrecoverytalk.com. Go there for all those episodes. All right. So in this episode, we have John. John is a dear friend of Ben's, and I haven't known John really that much. We've encountered each other a couple times, but Ben and John know each other pretty well. So again, Ben comes, says, hey, I got somebody that I think would be good on the podcast, super solid dude in recovery, and you know, has a good message. Let's get him on the show. All right, sounds good. And so here we are. We, prior to the episode, just discussed a couple of things that we're gonna talk about, and it's gonna be a lot on sponsorship, which John is very
adamant
about.
That's a good word.
And also some differences between private-run treatment centers and more state-run treatment centers, or maybe not a state-run treatment center, but
non-for-profit.
And also he's going to talk about himself and what, you know, led him down the path that got him to where he is today. So without further ado, John, appreciate you coming on. Just give us a quick and dirty elevator version of you, where you're from, what happened, you know, and then what it's like now.
Okay. Yeah. Again, you know, my name's John and I'm an alcoholic. I actually preface this by saying I'm a real alcoholic because it says that in the book. And I like that. I was born in New Orleans. So, of course, that right there started my drinking career, and probably started it very earlier. I mean, I hear people saying that they oh, I'm from Boston, I drink. Oh, I'm from, you know, Brooklyn, I drink. Oh, I'm from this place, San Francisco, I drink, or whatever, you know. But let me tell you what, New Orleans is the drinking capital, okay? I mean, when you could drive up to a daiquiri shop and leave with a 151 topper on a daiquiri and go out and drive in traffic and not have to worry about getting stopped, that is a drinking city.
To drive through, literally?
Drive through. Yeah. Now they're making masks in New Orleans with straw holes.
Awesome.
I heard that from my relatives, so that are out there. Anyway, so you know, I was born and raised in New Orleans, born to a boy, alcoholic. My dad was a real alcoholic. He was a beer drinking, loved to fight. My mom said he was a cheater. He was mean, and when he would drink, and he really, I think, I got really good pictures of my early childhood, you know, with my dad and stuff like that. But it was a few that I could see where he had a beer there, you know, like we'd eat crawfish, or went to the Shriners Circus. Got a picture of us going to the Shriners Circus, and my dad's got a Dixie beer. They used to have a Dixie brewery in New Orleans, with local breweries there, and. I think I was, you know, so I was raised by an alcoholic father. My mom and dad divorced when I was probably about 5 or 6 because my dad really got really abusive. And then I was, I have a younger brother who became a heroin addict in his 20s and was on methadone. He was in the Army. So their treatment plan was methadone. And I think he was on methadone for years, years and years. And he's an active alcoholic. He's out there. He doesn't like what I do. Now, my mom was not an alcoholic. She was a normie, but I can understand where my dad drank because my mom was she's a pistol. So anyway, grew up in New Orleans, you know, started drinking, you know, casually, you know, in high school. And you know, I think, you know, people were say, oh, I remember my first drink. What I remember was that I think I was the only one that anytime there was a football game or something like that, I was always the guy. I was very lucky that my mom remarried to my stepfather was a pharmacist. So we had a lot more money. Went from, you know, just a classic, you know, 3-2 suburban. And we wound up being, you know, a lot more affluent. So when I turned 15, I got a brand new car. And I wrecked about 5 or 6 cars from high school to college. But I remember, like, I can remember right now picking my friends up, go to a football game, and I would be the one with a good couple of big, you know, handles in the trunk, pushing the alcohol on everybody. You know, I can remember, you know, pulling up to my friend's house, already having I would get a Slurpee and get some rum and pour it in, and I would drink and drive. And that's how I was raised. So I went through life like that. You know, I went through college like that, got in accidents, got in trouble. I tried to commit suicide because I didn't know what was wrong with me. When, you know, I joined a fraternity and was just more stuff. So anyway, I didn't finish college there for 2 years. And you know, I wasted that away because I was going to school for architecture. And I could have went through the whole thing, you know, if I had not been not knowing that, you know, what was wrong with me. So I came back to New Orleans and my mom remarried. Well, my stepfather had died. And then my mom remarried with someone that was from West Palm Beach, Florida. I'm from New Orleans. She moved to West Palm Beach, Florida, and I followed. So I thought maybe my mom knew about my problems because, I mean, she was replacing the cars, right? So we thought maybe a geographical change come to Florida, right? In New Orleans, the bars were open 24 hours. Florida, you know, they closed at like 3, you know? So I came to Florida back in 1986, and I mean, my partying followed because I found Fort Lauderdale and Miami. So, you know, it didn't change. Going through, man, you know, I was a really good functioning alcoholic. I could say because I went through life tearing up stuff, never getting a DUI. I should have got 1,000. Never got a DUI. Never. I can't believe it. People are mad at me because of that. And, you know, just I went through. I never really lost anything. I mean, we moved to Albuquerque, moved to New Jersey. You know, lived in apartments. You know, bought used rental furniture. You know, at some point because you know my coke. Well, I guess I could talk a little bit about dry goods, but my cocaine usage was pretty good. So I am a little bit of an addict, I guess. I guess maybe we all are. But came back to West Palm Beach. I lived in West Palm Beach for until 2013. So I was a loan officer. I worked in banking, you know, kept a job, owned a nice home, a nice car, you know, and everything. And I got in a bad car accident in May 8th of 2013. I was rear-ended by a dump truck. And I was sitting at a red light. And so I wasn't drinking or anything. I was actually coming back to my office from a closing midday. And that's what changed my life. So I couldn't work anymore. The next day, I looked fine. I didn't have any scars or nothing, but I had damage to my spine and my neck. We ultimately found out. So didn't work for about a year and a half, I guess, because I got sober July. So I stayed home because I had to, and there was a big lawsuit, everything else, and it was true. I wound up having to have back surgery, a level 2 fusion on my lower back, and neck surgery, level 2 fusion on my neck. So I had real injuries. I ultimately, what happened was, you know, staying home. So, you know, like I always said that I wouldn't start drinking until Tuesday or Wednesday, you know, but really it was Monday, you know, it was Monday and Tuesday, not Wednesday or Thursday, like I said, you know, because I would hide my drinking. So staying home, I didn't realize, man, the bottle started calling me more and more. So I started drinking more during the day because I was home alone. So my drinking and then going through all this really trauma that I went through with these really, really intense surgeries, like 90 days in a back brace, you know, but I still was able to get this is why I knew I was a real alcoholic, because I changed my pharmacy from CVS to Walgreens because the Walgreens had a liquor store right next door, you know, so I hid bottles. I would buy like 6-8 handles and hide them in different places in the garage and stuff like that. And I never drank straight from the bottle or never drank straight vodka ever before. You know, I was functioning. And then I started not functioning. And I started finding myself hiding bottles all around the house. And then I was drinking straight from these bottles. Okay. I mean, that's what I had to do. And my doctor finally said, she goes, look, you having liver problems? Oh, my esophagus was burnt up. She goes, you know, John, what's going on? And I was seeing a therapist and a psychiatrist for trauma and, you know, for the accident, and nobody knew. So I have friends that I'll tell anybody out there that doesn't know, believe that the program will work. But I have friends, coincidentally, it's kind of funny when you think about it, that have 15, 20, 25, and 39 years of sobriety that I'd known for 25 years. And I was always around these friends, and they were in AA. And they would try to get me to a meeting by saying, oh, there's a barbecue at the Triangle Club. Why don't you come? They're going to have free food and stuff. And I remember going in there. And, you know, I had all these, I have a dozen friends that have, you know, that I'm still friends with, right? That have a lot of long sobriety. And they would try to get me in. They would, you know, and I remember going in the Triangle Club and looking up around, and I'd see all those phrases that they have. If anybody's been in the Triangle Club, like, you know, don't quit before the miracle. And you know, I mean, they had all the sayings up there, right? And I remember looking at my friends and like, what are you trying to do? I'm like, look, I have a saying. And you know what? This is my saying, okay? I'll tell you, I'm not a quitter. You know, and so that's what I said. So that was my saying, right? And I was really rude to them. I mean, I told them there was a cult, all the kind of stuff that you probably don't want to hear when you probably need it, right? So long story short, one of my friends happens to be an interventionist. And she was staying at our house. She lived in Canada, but worked for a treatment center in Salt Lake City, Utah. And because she worked for the airlines, she took care of all the flight attendants that had to go to treatment or got a DUI or anybody in the flight attendant industry, almost every airline, she did their interventions over the phone and got them to the treatment center, right, through their union. So anyway, she was staying with us. I must have been a mess because I was drinking. I had Tramadol. I had cocaine in the house, you know, the booze. And I guess one night I was just a real mess in the kitchen, and her, my partner. It was like this perfect storm, you know, like the two storms coming together, the three storms, because I was a storm. I was that tornado, right? I was a tornado. And I was that tornado that was at the bottom, at the very bottom of the tornado. That's where I knew I was. Because I remember looking in the mirror saying, that you were in the bathroom mirror, you're an alcoholic. Because I was drinking. I said, you're an alcoholic just like your old man. And, so she goes, she came in from Canada, found some of my hidden bottles in the guest bedroom drawer where she went to put her stuff away. I forgot to take them out. So they came rolling and clanking in together. And so she came in the kitchen. She came in the kitchen with two bottles and she's like, her father died of alcoholism. She goes, you know what? I'm not going to allow this. This is it. I've been putting up with it. And so she says, you're going to treatment. And so that was July 20. I said, and you know what? I'm gonna tell you, I never done any of this stuff. I never did any AA or this or that. You know, I thought it was a bunch of crap because I could manage myself. And I knew. And when she said that I was going to go to treatment, she gave me two choices to go: Salt Lake City or a place in Palm Springs. And Salt Lake City had private rooms, so I said, oh, I'll go there. And I don't know why I said I'll go, because that was not like me. I mean, I said I'll go. I knew. So that she said, okay, you're going to go. You're going tomorrow. And I'm like, no, I got too much stuff to do. You know, I mean, I wasn't working. I got stuff to do, you know. So she gave me an extra 2 days. And I got on the plane July 22nd, 2014. And got picked up. Went into treatment. And I was really the thing that really amazes me is that, you know, as much of as a real alcoholic as I was, I didn't fight when I got there. Like I even started. I think I had when I got there, and I was taken in for assessment or whatever, and I had a therapist. Oh, that's another thing. My therapist and my doctors, they, when I said I'm leaving to go to treatment, they're like, for what? I mean, that's how good I hid. I hid my shit. You know, I hid it. And my therapist said, she asked me how much did I drink? And I said, I don't know if, you guys get guys here that come in after, like if they're big, bad, blowout. And then they come in a day or two later. So I got my cocksureness back, like in the book, it says that, we get our cocksureness back. And so I told my therapist, I said, maybe like 3 or 4 drinks a day. Right. And she had a double master's. And so she looked at me and she goes, oh, we might have a problem. And I'm like, problem? What? What do you mean a problem? She goes, I don't think your insurance is going to, you're not really fit up for this treatment program that you might actually, you're going to have to pay for your plane ticket and you might have to go back. And I'm like, and so I said, oh, okay, whatever, I shrugged. And that night, this is what happened. I'm going to tell you, this is what happened. That's what I'll start where it for me. So I did that, right? And I was cocky. And then I didn't even realize that, oh, shit, I was going to be going to AA meetings. Like, I knew I was going to treatment, but didn't even think that I was going to be going to AA meetings. So that first night in treatment, so the place was, can I say the name of the treatment center? Recovery mm-hmm. Ways in Salt Lake City, Utah. It saved my life. Very similar to a place like this that I really respect. They had us do our first step in a group session, and we had to read basically like our drunk log or something like that was, the unmanageability of our life. And that first night there, I didn't know anybody. So I'm the kind of guy that, that when I sit next to somebody I know or just learn, I could kind of warm up to you and I'm a little talkative and like you could probably tell. And, but that night when I got in that circle and I didn't know anybody, I didn't know who was to the right or left across from me. And I sat in that circle for the first time alone. And there was a girl there that was, I remember, I'll never forget, Jennifer from New Jersey, that said her story. And she talked about growing up alcoholically. And she talked about being abused and sexually abused. And she got raped in high school and raped in college. And then she wound up going down the dark trail of becoming a stripper and then prostitution. And she was like in her early 30s and looked like she was 50 years old. And she had shown where she had tried to commit suicide twice in the bathtub, and she had the scars, and her scars were up and down her arm, not across. And when she said, and I still get chills right now thinking about that. And I remember, like right now, my whole body's getting chilly. And something about her, like she was an angel that was sent, I think, to me. Because that night I went to an AA meeting, and then the next day I went to go. So the next day I go to see the psychiatrist after being with the therapist. And he looks at the chart. He goes, John, he goes, you know, I don't, you know, like he kind of said what Rebecca said, like, you know, you only drink 3 or 4 times a day. I don't think we have a problem. And I said, you know what? I said, yeah, I only drink 3 or 4 times a day. I said, but that's out of each bottle. And I said, I probably have about 8 to 10 bottles hidden around the house, doctor. And that's, I can't believe it. Like for me, I don't know. I must have needed it. I didn't have that kind of that bottom that a lot of people had. I had to go to jail. You know, I didn't lose my house. I didn't do this. But, you know, spiritually, I was bankrupt.
How old were you when you
my
got
age?
Help?
Oh, yeah, come on, Dan. All right. So let's see. I'm 58 years old right now. So it's 52 or 53. Yeah.
And the reason I ask that is, you know, we get a lot of phone calls. And, you know, in my honest opinion, one of the challenges is when you got somebody with so much life experience, it's we have a really hard time getting them to change. And, you know, part of the big reason I wanted John to come on the podcast is the fact that here you got a guy 50 years of life behind him, living his life a certain way for so long. And then you've just really jumped into the deep end of the pool with this stuff. And, you know, actually, I was having a discussion with some folks older than I am this morning, and I brought that up to him, like, that, you know, this is one of my concerns, is you're so stuck in your ways. You know, we get young people in, it's kind of easy to push them on their way because they're building something new. They have nothing. They're starting fresh, so to speak. But when you got someone that has so much roots, you know, I think sometimes age and life experience can be a handicap. Maybe ego ties into it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of stuff that you covered there. And one of the things that really stuck out for me was the fact that when you say you were hiding bottles, who were you hiding them from?
Oh, I was even hiding them from myself. Okay, well, all right. So I have a partner. I'm gay. And I have a partner that I'd been with probably at that point, 28, 29, 27, 26 years. Yeah. Yeah, probably 26 years. Yeah. Yeah.
And so
I was hiding them from him. So he didn't know how much I was drinking. I would keep one bottle above the refrigerator that he would check. And I would take just one drink out of that one every day. And then I would use the other one. So like I maybe had 5 or 6 or 7 drinks, but it looked like I had one, and he fell for it.
So your whole entire life, it sounds like you, and honestly, I mean, I imagine you were pretty successful at yes. everything that you did. I mean, a loan officer for a bank, you know, pretty.
We owned 5 rentals plus our primary home.
Yeah, so on paper, everything is fine. You know, you have everything that society tells us that we need. But deep down inside here, we have somebody that's got 8 to 10 bottles scattered around the house. And, you know, you were maybe a sophisticated drinker to begin with, and then you start drinking directly out of the bottle. And for some people, that's like snorting an Oxy versus now you're shooting it up. You know, and it's kind of in the same, like, I've graduated I can't even make it to the freezer to get a couple ice cubes to have my vodka on rocks. I'm just going to swig it right out of the bottle.
Rocks? Why would you put rocks on those?
Yeah. So, you know, the progression is there. And for you, I see that I think the point that I'm trying to make is that very successful, own 5 houses. You know, everything on the surface is good. On paper is really good. You know, and most people would say, yeah, John, why are you going to treatment?
Nobody knew why, even my mom, nobody knew why I left. First of all, I didn't want anybody to know. I told my mom I was going to visit my friend in Canada because if I quit, right? Because I was told that I could quit. I didn't want anybody to know that I went and left. It was the weirdest thing. Like what? I mean, I hid that, but, you know, midway through, I actually started opening up, because I really, that next day when I, you know, after that after Jennifer, I was like helping people, other people in the house already, other guys and girls, you know, I mean, I was like rah, rah.
I think something that, and I want to discuss this point just for a minute, because Ben and I see people that come in to rock that have this mentality of, I don't really want people knowing about this. I want to keep this under wraps. And we try, and that's okay coming in. Most people aren't like, want to wear this. It's not a badge of honor that I'm an alcoholic at the beginning. But our job, and I think a big part of our job, is to help people understand that as you go through this process, as you go through the therapeutic process, it's not so much that we're identifying as an alcoholic, but we're okay with the fact that we're an alcoholic. And now, fast forward for you, you know, 5 years later, for Ben and I, you know, 10 years later, I can say to myself, to my friends and my family, I'm an alcoholic. You don't want to see me drink. Trust me, you don't. And I'm not ashamed of that. And people, over time, I feel, respect that. And when people can get to that point of being okay with who they are and understanding it's not a death sentence to be an alcoholic if you stop drinking and if you get into recovery. If you don't stop, then it is a death sentence, obviously. But when I think, so it's important to understand, it's not so much an identity as it is, you know, just being okay and open-minded and willing to be okay with being an alcoholic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, I think I see a lot of folks come in and they're worried about the stigma that might come along with it. And I'm just going to throw it out there. In my personal opinion, you're only adding to the stigma by keeping it to yourself. You know, I think it's important to show people what recovered alcoholics and drug addicts are capable of, because we're very capable, intelligent people. You know, if you think about everything that we're able to juggle in active addiction, like John's a perfect example. You were able to do that while you were drinking like that. What the hell are you able to do when you're not drinking? Like, think about that, you know, what we're able to accomplish.
I think one direction that we need to go is that, because you're obviously very vested in the recovery community here in Florida.
Immediately.
Yeah, in particular, West Palm Beach area. And it's no secret. People come here from all across the country to get sober. And you're kind of in the middle of it. And you have a pretty big commitment at a local. Go ahead and talk about that.
Let me tell you where I met John. I don't think we discussed that, right?
No, go ahead.
So I met John, 3 years ago?
3 years ago.
3 years ago at a spot called the Fern House here in West Palm Beach. You know, we do a big book study. And this is why I feel the way that I feel about John and the way he gets involved. I'm going to let him tell you about the Fern House, but to me, it says a lot about his character and the amount of time that he invests into going to a place like the Fern House. Tell us what the Fern House is like, John.
So, all right, so, you know, I got sober at a really cushy, very nice treatment center. I mean, it looked like a Marriott resort hotel. That's what it had. It's like a ski lodge, you know, lobby and all this stuff. So very nice, like here. That got me sober. That took me away from drugs and alcohol. And then when I came home and started going to meetings and got a sponsor and then started learning the importance of sponsorship, that became real important for me to do when I was able to do. You know, I was nervous about it, but I had known about the Fern House before because we would get guys to work. It's a men's only facility. We would get guys to work sometime doing work in our yard or house or paint or this, because the guys look for extra work there. And I was doing this for years before. So I knew about it from my friends that are sober, because one of them, she was on the board at the Fern House. And so the Fern House is in West Palm Beach. It is a men's only facility. It is a non-for-profit. It's really what you'd call it. It's no way is it a treatment center, but it is a halfway house. And it's run though like a work release program. I mean, lights out at 10:30, I think. You know, you got to get up at 5 or 5:30. You got in your first phase or second phase. They got four phases, I think. They are in your first and second phase. You got to get up and do duties. You got to clean bathrooms. You got to maybe might have to help get the breakfast ready. They have a one of the guys is a cook, and then he gets a few guys that help. And so they pay rent there. It's not free, even though it's non-for-profit. They pay $220 a week, and it includes their meals. The Fern House is where guys go that come out of jail and prison.
I would venture to say probably 90%.
90%. My two guys right now, one's from prison and one's from jail.
And we get guys too, you know, we come across, we end up taking them through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like literally there'll be guys that show up there and they're like, yep, I just finished 15 years, just got out this week, you know, and that... They've got nothing.
I never got a DUI. I never got arrested. Never been in jail. Never been in prison. Right? I joke with my guys. Oh, like John, you know, you don't know what it's like. So, oh, man, look, I remember when I was 15 years old. I tried. No, I almost been to jail or prison. I said when I was 15 years old, I got caught trying to steal a belt at D.H. Holmes, and they took me in the security room.
That's the same with me. I got caught when I was probably around the same age. I got caught stealing a Zippo lighter at Walmart, and they took me in the security room, and that scared the living shit out of me.
I swear to God, because, you know, when I look at my history of how many cars I wrecked and everything, and I'm like, my God, you know, I should have had 1,000 DUIs. And when I realized that God was always there. Like, God kept me out of scrapes that I got in accidents. I should have been mangled and dead by now, you know? That's a real big important thing that I when I sponsor, that we try to cover on, you know, is our relationship with God. And, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys, you know, some make it, some don't, you know, but what I'm told is the important thing is that the sponsor still stays sober, you know, but it's my job. I feel that 12th step to me is besides the first step, which is I got to stay sober. And then the 12th step is continuing the message. All the steps are in between their maintenance steps, you know, but I got to do the first and the 12th. That's how I feel, you know, other people feel different ways, you know, and I think Ben and I related with each other because I'm a big book thumper. I mean, you know, I can't quote like, oh, exactly out of, you know, like verbatim, but I know a lot. I mean, I've read that book so many times now, and I'm not a book reader. I mean, I'm not a book reader, but it's amazing what I got. 'Cause, you know, reading this book on your own, you're not going to get it. You need to have someone to read it with you.
Let me ask you this. I think, because again, I'm going to always reference people that are new to this. And this is what this podcast is really. It's dedicated to families, loved ones that are dealing with people like myself, you and Ben. But it's also for people that are struggling with addiction and alcoholism and they don't really know what to do or where to turn. But a lot of times, first question is, did you have the impression of, okay, I'm John and I am a loan officer. I own 6 homes and I don't see how on earth I'm going to be able to relate with any of these people that are, you know, an alcoholic. Like you said before, I'm not a quitter, one, but I can't relate with a lot of these people in these meetings and stuff. They probably got, you know, live under a bridge and everything else. That's the first question. How was that? How did you perceive that, you know, new in sobriety versus how it is now? Because here you are, the still John, the very successful person who is in successful in real estate and everything else that you do. And now you're taking other guys that have been in prison and jail and stuff. And they may look at you in the beginning and say, John, you can't really relate, man. You didn't spend 15 years stint in prison. Talk about that a little bit, like how the mindset shift.
Okay, so when I first said that I was going to go, you know, to treatment, the first thing I thought about was, I said, oh shit, there's going to be drug addicts and alcoholics there. I can't bring any jewelry. I mean, I got a nice Rolex. I got, you know, some other, I'm like, okay. So the first thing I did, I remember this, is I went out and bought a nice Timex. Cause I liked having a watch on my hand. So I bought a really cool looking Timex. I remember that cause I'm thinking, man, there's going to be drug addicts and alcoholics there. You know, I mean, so you know what? When I got there, there were drug addicts and alcoholics. And that's, I kind of thought like that at first. And I'd never seen so many tattoos before in my life. You know what I mean? I lived in downtown West Palm Beach in a historic neighborhood and worked for a bank, you know? And I didn't really know. I mean, I got uncles that have tattoos. They've been in prison. And
don't you have tattoos now? Yeah, he got sucked in. Look at the size of that.
I got a full leg. And I got one on the other side. Yeah, I got. So it's kind of funny because my mom said, you know, oh, you waited till you're 50-something years old to start getting tattoos on your body. And you know what? No, that's how I related. It was like the weirdest thing. It's like once I found these people and people had been in the, you know, in the treatment center, there had been some guys, I think, that, because it wasn't all flight attendants. It was like 30% from Salt Lake City. And I started relating with people that were in jail and prison, right? I mean, I thought I was better. You know what? You know, this is what I'm going to tell you for anybody out there that's struggling. This is how I knew I had a problem. Anybody that thinks they don't have a problem is that when you're successful like me, when you're hiding bottles, and also because I was drinking so much vodka, Kettle One was my favorite. Because I always say my favorite cocktail was Kettle One and cocaine, right?
That was a Kettle One drinker.
Yeah. So my drinking got so much that I had to switch down from Smirnoff to Skol and pour it in the Kettle One bottle. So people thought they were getting, and I was buying at the end, I was like the cheap rock gut vodka in the plastic handles without even a handle on it, you know, and that's what I switched to. So anybody that sees that kind of activity, you might have a problem. And that's how I came in. You know, I mean, I was lying to myself even, you know, because here I'm got the, you know, the Kettle One. I would keep like four or five vodkas above the microwave, you know, and I'd have a Great Goose, Kettle One, you know, all these different fancy ones, but they would ultimately just be whatever I bought, poured in, you know, and that's what, you know, it was a lie. I was living a lie at even being successful. Didn't matter.
I think too, going back to what Tom was saying, you know, for folks that are new to this, one thing that I see a lot of the times, I see it with our clients, is they're like, oh, I found a sponsor who's just like me. I think sometimes that can be a negative in a way. I'm a firm believer that when you find somebody who's appearances wise completely different from you, probably came from a different background, we actually tend to get more out of that. You know, we've got a guy now who basically is like, oh yeah, I got a sponsor, he's also a banker, he's also this, he's also grew up in Maryland and DC, like, and goes on and on about all the same things that they have in common material wise but when you take somebody who comes from a different part, you know, different, what's the word I'm looking for? Starts with the
background,
that works. When you have someone that comes from a different background, you're forced to figure out what you do have in common, you know? And I think there's a lot of growth just in that, finding somebody that's different from you, hearing a different perspective, you know, at the end of the day, it's funny because I've had a sponsee that's close to 70 years old when I was 30. You know, I was less than half his age, yet we found what we had in common. You know, he was an attorney, and I was working as a tech at a treatment center. You know, you would think nothing in common, but when we sat down and read the big book together, it was an incredible experience.
You had everything in common.
I learned so much from him, even though I was sponsoring him, like it, you know, and I was really surprised when he asked me to be a sponsor too, you know, and it's cool to see how that works and to get to experience some of that. I think that's a big part of this program. And I guess where I'm going with it is, don't sell yourself short by trying to find somebody exactly like you, because that's probably, you probably need something different.
I did that and it didn't work for me, and I wound up losing money because I saw a guy that was ultimately became a scam artist, and he in the rooms, and I got him as a sponsor, and he ultimately was a bad decision. You know, my most successful, you know, like, it's really hard to keep sponsees. I do everything I can, but they have to do the work. But, you know, Ben had always said, I got one of my sponsees that's going to have 3 years in August, Matt. And he's like, he goes, you guys got nothing in common. You know, Matt's 31 years old. He's straight. He's been to jail multiple times. He's been to gun club. He's been to J Ministries. He's been to Dunklin. He's been at Fernhouse, in and out of the Fernhouse like 6 times, 7 times.
These are all state run facilities.
State run facility. Dunklin is 11 months. It's a faith based thing, and you have to build work all day and build pallets and stuff like that. He's been through all this stuff, and he met me on the Wednesday night where Ben and I met. He came in as a resident at Fernhouse, and he asked me to be a sponsor. And you know, the kid's going to have 3 years in August. And Ben, you said many times,
dude, you want to see two guys that look like they have nothing in common. It's really funny to watch the dynamic between the two of, like, we, you know, when we do fellowship stuff after Fernhouse, like we would go out to Flanagan's there, yeah, man, and you just watch those two, like, it's funny, but like you could tell, like, the brotherly love, yeah, that's there. It's, I mean, I look at you two and I would label you as like best friends at this point,
mm-hmm,
you know, but they are really cut from, I don't know, dude.
The opposite. I mean, yeah, we could not be more further opposite. But you know what? We have, you know, the thing we had was the desire. So if you got the desire to stay sober, that's the person that will get you sober. You got to have somebody that's got the same desire as you. And it doesn't matter what they look. It doesn't matter what kind of car they drive. It doesn't matter where they come from. If they, you know, if they got a Timex or a Rolex, it doesn't matter. I ultimately found that out, you know, and that's why. I don't know, you know, like, you know, you would think that maybe I would want to be, you know, oh, maybe, you know, just only picking up sponsees, you know, in cushy meetings and, you know, picking out through better meetings and stuff like that, because that's the kind of world I came from. But I'm sober, you know, after a lot of stuff. I went through a really bad breakup that was really bad. Ben knows about the breakup, and I stayed sober during that. I've had a couple things happen that I stayed sober. And I think the only reason I stayed sober is because I still worked the 12. I didn't screw with the 12th step, because a lot of people say, well, John, you know, you do a lot of work. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm sober. Like, I don't want to mess with it. And it'll work. I don't care if you're 19 years old or 59 or 79 years old, you know, just, you know, for once listening, getting the message. Because you know what I said, so I came in that room. And I said, I was an asshole. I came in that room in the Triangle Club and said, you know, I got my phrase, you know, I'm not a quitter. Well, what I could say today is that I have a phrase, and that phrase is now, I'm not a quitter. Because I will not go back to drugs or alcohol. I don't need to. You know, I don't need that. I don't need the sensation that comes from taking a drink or drug to deal with my problems, or just to even deal with a good night, a good Wednesday night. You know, why not? You know, it didn't have to be stressful. Didn't have to be a stressful day. And I don't have to do that now. You know, the answer and the help and the solution. Oh, no, that's the word I wanted with solution is by going through the steps, you know, picking, you know, sponsorship to me is really important. Really, really important. I when I get a sponsee, I tell them right off the bat, you know, if you want me as a sponsor, you better be ready to take other guys down the road with you, you know, and do it. A lot of guys don't, unfortunately. They say they will. So, you know, it says in the beginning of my book, you know, I have them write a little thing, it's a me and God contract, and it's taken right from the book. And it says that I will go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And I add drugs in there, and I have them sign that. any lengths. And I've had this conversation where guys want to be, you know, very nonchalant about their program. And I'm like, dude, that's not any lengths. You know, and most of them don't stay sober. I mean, one of my, I got a sponsee that is probably very successful. I don't want to say more successful than me. I'm just going to say he's very successful. He keeps relapsing, you know, because I don't think he wants to, you know, he doesn't give in that he is, you know, because sometimes he would make comments about the Fernhouse, you know, like he's better than them. And that would piss me off because I'm like, look, man, you are no different. I don't care if you're vice president, Ryan. You're no different than the guy that comes in from prison. You know, I got a guy right now that just came in from 6 years and he is really making me proud. You know, he's got his family back. He texts me pictures of him. He got a new baby in December. And, you know, that's the, you know, he gets to go home on the weekends because he gets passes because he's been there now 4 months. You know, and he loves, he told me the other night, they have a meeting that they have to do at the Fernhouse. They do a lot of meetings at the Fernhouse, first of all. There's a lot of meetings, okay? And he's like, John, he said this last night to me on the phone. This guy's 30 years old. He's 30 years old. Been in prison, young, way younger than me. Got a wife and two children. And he said, John, you know, the Chuck does this, you know, relapse prevention meeting, you know, and stuff on Tuesday nights. He goes, man, but you know what? Thursday night when we read is when I get the, I feel the best. Because I always ask my guys after we read, how do you feel? You feel better, you feel worse? You know, 90% of the times they feel better because we talk first. I mean, I think that's important. Talk is important. Talk has kept me sober. You know, I talked to Ben. I haven't talked to Ben in a long time. I'm glad we kind of reached out to him for something. And I'm glad I miss it because I really, we met at this place on a Wednesday night. I'm still there. I have much less, you know, my life is pretty simple. I'm single. So, you know, I have open time for doing a lot of work. I don't make it every night, but I have the ability. I kept on with this Wednesday night big book meeting, I enjoy it. You know, it's a big part of my life.
I think one of the biggest things that you said there, with especially the guys that you take through the steps and stuff, and having those conversations with them and just talking with them, it's a lot about what we do here at the center is treating people like they're humans. You know, I mean, it's a humanistic approach. This is, I like the fact that you have them, you know, sign a contract in the beginning and says, are you willing to go to any length? Now, a lot of people could look at that and think, well, what is this about? Why am I having to sign a contract? And like, what, you know, what this could be scary for some people, you know, but in reality, and I think that's where there's that human connection, right? You're having a conversation with them and that trust is built. I mean, if you email me a contract and say, all right, here, sign this and blah, blah, I'm like, no, thanks. But I've, at this point, if I'm approaching you as a sponsor, we've had many conversations, I'm sure. I'm sure you've talked with your sponsees at length prior to becoming their sponsor, maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. But there's a human connection there, and they mm-hmm. trust you. And they trust you enough to sign a contract. Obviously, it's not a bearing contract of any sorts, but it's just that initiative. Hey, I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to maintain my sobriety. I used to have people sign contracts when I sold cars. It's not anything the same way. I would say, Ben, you know, if all right, you told me the numbers that you want. I don't know if I can get these numbers done or not. But if I can get these numbers done, are you going to buy the car today?
We'll see, Tom.
All right, so just give me your initials in the top right-hand corner of this paper. All that does, it shows some initiative on your end, and I'll go into my finance manager, and if he sees those initials, he's going to fight a lot harder to get those numbers done because it shows commitment on your end. Are you willing to do that?
Sure, Tom.
So it's different, you know? But that's the only contracts I'd have people's. But I like that, and I think that that's important, that, you know, having people understand, like, this isn't... this isn't a game. This isn't something that we just kind of, oh, yeah, I'll work the steps. Will you be my sponsor? Blah, blah, blah. And I think 90% of the time people come at it with that approach, like not really understanding the severity of the problem and the amount of work that has to go into this.
Well, I want to touch on part of my experience in particular with at the Furnace. I've been sober nearly 10 years now. The 2 years that I was going to the Fern House on Wednesday nights, it's like we have a 2-hour window. It's a 2-hour big book study every Wednesday. I think I missed it twice over those 2 years. Mm-hmm. But I've been sponsoring the entire time I've been sober, minus the first like couple months I was going through my steps. I will tell you this. I got more guys consistently through their 12 steps and through that process at the Fern House than any other years of my sobriety. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they've hit that low bottom too. Like, if you're at the Fern House, you got two places to go. Either the parole officer is looking for you because you screwed up, or you're going back out to the street.
The streets.
Like, to sleep on the sidewalk. And so when I show up every Wednesday night or whenever it was during the week to read with these guys, like if I had a sponsee, I'd go another night to read with them outside of that Wednesday. I got more guys through all 12 steps probably more consistently than anywhere. It's that desperation is there. You know, they've hit that bottom. They want to change their life. And I tell you this, there's nothing more rewarding than seeing a guy who has nothing, no job, no car. They're really homeless if they're not at the Fern House, and watch them build lives. There's one guy in particular that just sticks out to me. You know, he's got a couple of years now, but I saw him at the Fern House. He wasn't allowed to see his son, you know, and then like about a year later, I started coaching peewee football, and all of a sudden I see him out at the field. I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, oh, I'm here out with my son. I bring my son to football. And like now he has his own place. He has a car. Like literally went from having nothing to a year or two later, he's out there on the football field with his kid working for the city. You know, and seeing that happen, that says a lot in my book, and it's really inspirational.
Yeah, if anybody out there thinking that maybe they're too good for the program or anything, I could tell you for true and from my experience that, you know, this is a progressive illness, and when you relapse and you if you're having a problem staying sober, one of the old timers says, he goes, you know, John, have you ever seen anybody come in these rooms after relapsing, right? On the wings of glory. Has anybody come out with a new driving up with a new BMW, bought a condo on the intercoastal? You know, I tell guys, I said, this week gets worse and worse, you know, for anybody that's having a problem staying sober. For the people that don't know it, like me, I didn't know anything. So for anybody that was out there that didn't know anything, I thought that when I went to treatment, I was going to be able to come back and at least drink coffee and Kahlua.
Coffee and what?
Kahlua. I thought I could drink my Kahlua. Like, I thought, okay, I'm not going to be able to do any more drugs, and I'm not going to be able to drink any more vodka, but at least I know that I could have my Kahlua and my coffee, and that's all. And when they told me I couldn't have any alcohol, I didn't know jack shit when I came in. So anybody that's new out there, that's where I was, right? And I thought that I would be able to come back home and drink coffee and Kahlua. And they told me Kahlua is liquor. And I'm like, yeah, but it's a flavor. I use it for flavoring. I just keep pouring it, right? And I thought I was never, I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to drink coffee again. Like, that's it. They're going to ruin my life. But now, I don't, like, I got coffee right here. I got two Starbucks, you know, cylinders, stainless steel, you know, mugs in my car. You know, I mean, I can drink coffee without alcohol. I mean, I found that out. I can go to the movies without alcohol. I can go to a concert without alcohol. I can go into a bar. I've gone to weddings, and I've gone to even early sobriety and went to the, not only the wedding, but let's say the rehearsal dinner the night before where the family, you know, goes with the rehearsal, and that's usually where everybody's got the hangover from, you know, and I've got to go to that and stay sober. and then nobody feel like shit the next day. I've seen them. I've been to it. And nobody got in fights, you know, and everything else. And I can do anything I want sober and be happy, you know. So for anybody out there that's having a struggle or a fight and thinking that, oh, my life is going to be over if I quit. I thought my life was going to be over if I quit drinking vodka, you know. It's not true. It's a lie. It's a lie that it's a lie that you have a disease that tells you that this is going to be like that. I learned that, you know, I learned a lot. I was very fortunate to come into a place like this where I learned about the addiction that I had. I'm able to share that with my guys that haven't had the, ability or, you know, to go to a nice treatment center, because the Fernhouse really doesn't, when we talk about the Fernhouse, they have a lot of meetings and they have, but there's no therapist there or anything like that. So there is no, you know, therapy, you know. So the only thing that they get is when like a guy like Ben or myself, you know, that could actually even give them a little bit more information about the disease, you know, other than what you get in the meetings and stuff like that. So, I pass that on. And most, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's taken with acceptance.
I like the word that you use, Ben. People in places like the Fern House or Dunklin or Faith Farm or all these places, I mean, these are end of the road, next to prison, jails, institutions, and death, right? But that word desperation, I think, is what sets people apart from places like that versus places like us. I mean, I think we're an amazing facility and we do very good work. But people sometimes come in here with a chip on their shoulder. And, you know, there's a saying in South Florida, I mean, not just South Florida, everywhere, that the recovery starts when the insurance stops, you know? And it's like, okay, do you want to find yourself in a place like Fern House? Or do you want to do the work now? It's entirely up to you.
About 2 weeks ago, I had a discussion with the mother whose son was coming into our program, and she kept reiterating, my son, you know, he does heroin, but he's never stolen from anybody. He's never been in fights. And I finally said to the mom, I said, you keep reiterating this point, like other than the heroin, everything's okay. I said, your son's just never been in a position where he's had to steal. There's yet. No difference, because they were talking about his roommate who had no family to support him, who had nothing, how he was a thief and bringing stuff to the pawn shop and robbed him. I said, your son would do that too if he wasn't fortunate to have the family that he has. The only difference between that guy and your son and the junkie on the street sleeping on the concrete, the only difference there is a set of circumstances that he's lucky to be in and not doesn't have any ownership or responsibility in it.
All right. So that I call the yets. They said, oh, John, I've never been to prison. I said yet. Let me tell you one word that I learned coming in here was the yets, because guess what? I had not had a DUI. Well, before I came in, was sent to, before I call it institutionalized, I was actually I was so paranoid going out to go to the drugstore or to the liquor store and stuff like that I was so afraid I was going to get caught by the police. I wouldn't want to go get gas. 2 times I ran out of gas in my neighborhood inebriated. And let me tell you, if my neighbors didn't know that I had to push my car to my house, that I was drunk, no. I would, the next thing I would have gotten was going to be jail. I would have gotten a DUI. I was at that point. I can't believe, I don't know how I didn't. I ran out of gas twice in my neighborhood. I would still think about that.
That'd be an embarrassing way to get a DUI.
It was pretty embarrassing. Let me tell you.
How'd you get a DUI? I ran out of gas. Believe that one. I'll tell you another. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the yets. So I always say, you know, if anybody's thinking, you know, well, you know, I haven't done that. I mean, this man, you know, I came in here. I was spiritually, morally bankrupt, but I accepted that because when I looked at myself, Okay, I'm going to tell you, this is a, when I looked at myself in the mirror and I said to myself, I talked to myself, I said, John, you're an alcoholic. I'm going to tell you, this, if this will help anyone, for my guys, I have a favorite song. So one of my favorite songs that I like to do, we even look at the words, is The Man in the Mirror by Michael Jackson. And it's, I'm looking at the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to change his ways. When you go through that song, I tell them we listen to that song. And I don't know why how could that be so inspirational from Michael Jackson from, 30 years ago, probably. But it's, I have to look at the man, the woman, the person in the mirror. I don't care if it's your rearview mirror or your bathroom mirror or a mirror. And you look at yourself and you talk to yourself and actually be honest with who you think you might be that no one knows. And that might help you out.
Well, here we are. We're coming up on an hour. And man, I think
it was another hour.
You can. I got to go to the bathroom, so you can go with Ben and talk all you want. But no, really appreciate you coming on, John. I think you have an amazing message. And I mean, I really think we could talk for another hour and then more. But most of all, I just want to express gratitude for the work that you do with the guys at the Fern House and the recovery community here. And just know we obviously have an open door policy. If you ever want to come here and talk with our people, by all means, I mean, I think they could probably gain a lot from your message. And Ben, appreciate you making the introduction here. I think we met the one time we met at
the Ale House.
We met at
was it that
called the Mexican restaurant off Palm Beach Lakes? Oh, Toreros.
Yeah. Toreros.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but just appreciate you coming on. And yeah, man, do you have anything else that you would want to say that before I stop recording, you're going to say, oh, crap, I forgot to say this?
No. The only thing I want to say is that I love places like this. I'm telling you, it was a place like this that got me sober. That's what got me sober. It took me away. I mean, I applaud the treatment centers, because there's so many ones that are bad. I learned so much, because I have a lot of friends. I got, actually, I know I never said this, but like one of my best friends, she's probably got about 15 years. She had relapsed after 15 years, and she's actually a psychotherapist, and she writes a lot of books, Dr. Donna Marks. And I just can't believe, they can't believe the difference. These are people that are in the field. So when I come into anybody that is looking for a place to come, don't be shy. Give your phone number. Your phone number.
Awesome. Ben, any final thoughts?
No, thanks, John, for coming out, man. You know I love you, man. And I too with Tom. I think there's a million more topics I could pick out of what we just talked about and keep going for hours, but we'll save that for another day. Maybe do a part two.
Part two.
Part two. Part two.
Part two. All right, that is it for this episode of Real Recovery Talk. Again, go to realrecoverytalk.com and get every single one of our episodes, and that is it. We will see y'all later.
Later.
You've been listening to Real Recovery Talk with Tom Conrad. If you'd like to have a confidential conversation about your specific situation, give Tom a call on his direct line at 561-220-7163. Or if you'd prefer, you can chat with Tom live at realrecoverytalk.com. As always, if this show is a benefit to you, please give it a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or wherever you discover your favorite podcasts. Thank you for being part of our mission to bring hope and healing to our loved ones struggling with addiction, as well as wisdom and comfort to those of us around them.